Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. And John, this is a perfect time, I think, for our podcast to focus a bit of its energy on race in America. It's a time when I think we're all thinking about that. And we know that brown and black populations have been so terribly impacted by COVID-19. Because of congregate living, because of lack of access to health care, it's just been an awful time. And, of course, we had all the civil unrest over the course of the summer. And so now we wonder, what does it all mean? Are we striving and moving toward what I would call a more perfect union? And that is the name of the book that we're going to be focusing on today on our podcast.
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, Larry, and I've said this before on other podcasts, that I think we are more integrated than we've ever been. Now, that's not to say that there isn't stuff that there's a lot to be done. We got education that needs to be fixed in the inner cities. The government has done things that has really kept people in poverty instead of getting them work. And that's another thing. We need jobs. But in my lifetime, at least, we are more and more integrated than ever. I look around at the schools. When I've gone places in the past when I could, you know, I've really seen, especially young people.
I think color means so much less to them than to previous generations. But I think what you're going to see and hear, because oftentimes I'm doing these interviews and John doesn't really hear them until later on in the process, because he puts them all together, massages them, and technically brings them together for you. But if you really go back, John, and you look at it, we've had some critical moments in American history after the Continental Congress, after the Civil War, after the Civil Rights Movement, after the election of Barack Obama, where a lot of people thought, this is the moment.
Absolutely.
This is our moment in time to make that change.
Especially with Barack Obama, right. I really thought we were going to have a different country in that time, and it didn't happen.
And he was very cautious too, because he knew his place in history and he wanted to be seen as a president of all Americans. And there'll be much written about that going forward. But I think what's really interesting about Calvin Baker is the way that he describes to us what real integration is. Now, I know we have moved in that direction, but John, just look at our own little suburb. We live in the same community. There's very little affordable housing. There's very little apartment and congregate housing. And there are very few African-American families in our own community. And we do not even subscribe to the 10% quotient for affordable housing. So there still is an exclusionary part of the American process that has really cut off access for African Americans in particular to change their status. And it's just not something that's changed readily, and there's been a lot of pushback. Every time we've had some movement forward, there's been pushback.
The other thing we got to figure out, I think, which is very important, is education. I think we've in this state here, we've thrown so much money at education, And I don't think we really have much to show for it. So we need some better ideas for education.
Well, we did
so
that podcast.
Everybody gets an equal education.
Right. You know? Well, we did that podcast, as you recall, John, about a year ago, where Stanford and Yale got together. No, it was Harvard and Stanford. And they looked at the last 50 years of equity and excellence in education and came to the conclusion, no matter how many changes we've made to charter schools and funding and the like, that it really just hasn't moved the needle. And what I really worry about post-pandemic is that any child who's two or three grades behind to begin with, coming out of this, it's going to be just a horrible situation, and I wonder if they're ever going to be able to catch up.
Yeah. Oh, you're absolutely right. Well, this is to me, because that's really, education is really your stepstone to get into good jobs. I mean, so that to me is one of the most important things, and I don't know, it just, we need some better ideas how to fix it.
Well, we also need a lot of systemic change that says that America really is open to everyone, that we're not really just a corridor of influence and privilege for some, but really open to all.
That's true. And I couldn't have said that better. But
I think Calvin Baker is really going to open our eyes to the possibilities here. And I do want to mention that beyond Calvin's talk today, we have other podcasts that we have scheduled. We've already recorded a few of them where we're going to be talking about race again. It's just a very important topic, and it's one that I think will be on the mind of the new administration as well. So let's dig in to a more perfect union, race, integration, and the future of America. Nothing less than that. Today on America Trends.
With me on the line is Calvin Baker, and he is a writer and a professor. He's written a lot of fiction books, but this one is certainly not fictional. It's called A More Perfect Reunion, Race, Integration, and the Future of America. And Mr. Baker, I've got to tell you, it's just a remarkable book. Historically so important in putting so many issues into context and then letting us really think about where we are today in America as it relates to integration. And it's interesting, that particular concept, because I think a lot of Americans think that we have integration in America, but you remind us we're very far from that.
Thank you, Larry. One of the things I hope to do with this book was contextualize where we are as Americans in this journey of multiculturalism, if you will, of race. And in my novels, I've written a lot, I've explored a great deal what it means to be a multicultural country, and as America has been since the colonial era. But one of the pressing concerns is, what does it mean for people of color to have real freedom and self-determination in this country? And I posit here that we've gone through three stages on the march to black freedom. And the first was abolition. The second, which was achieved with the emancipation during the Civil War. The second was desegregation. That was the aim, because after the Civil War, the country still didn't integrate it. It didn't bring black people into the fullness of American society. We see things like Jim Crow in the South, but also abject segregation in the North. And that was the stated goal of the Civil Rights Movement. Since then, we tell ourselves that we've come very far, and we have, in fact, come a certain distance, but we're also held still in this colonial frame wherein you have counter-historical forces that want to oppress others because of racial differences, because of ethnic differences. And we look around and we say, oh, well, I've got one of these and one of these and one of these, but you see opportunity still isn't available for massive numbers of people in this society.
I thought it was fascinating the way that you described the victor and the victims as it relates to the Civil War, because in fact you say never has a victor, if we assume those who were emancipated were the victors, been treated the way that victors in the Civil War were treated. I think that was such an incredibly powerful way of expressing the fact that Reconstruction was so short-lived and the Jim Crow era was so long in the making, the next 100 years. Can you go over that territory for us?
One of the things that early observers, and this begins in the colonial era when Americans first realize consciously, we have a race problem here. And people, there are many founders who, and there are many supporters of the revolution who saw slavery as antithetical to democracy and said as much. De Tocqueville notices this and says, forthright, the problem, and even in those states where emancipation has already happened, those northern states where slavery was abolished before the Civil War, there's an attitude of anti-blackness, of racial hatred. After the Civil War, in order to achieve there's a political compromise there that's vetted up, but the white North and the white South were able to paper over their differences at the cost of black freedom and black rights. And what you see is the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments that guarantee blacks the franchise and full citizenship are pushed back. The Supreme Court says, at the turn of the 20th century, well, we don't have the power to enforce, no one can enforce that. And that paves the way for Jim Crow, and that lets these, right, the physical and the political structures of racism that had obtained during slave times remain, and it stops the march. And we don't really take that up again until the 60s. So the country, and there had been a civil rights movement throughout the 20th century trying to achieve the same things that were guaranteed by those amendments after the war.
How many false starts toward this effort? And, of course, you quote Frederick Douglass, the future of African Americans was to be full participation in the material and moral life of American society. We're not there because you tell us that right now we're in the midst of a cold civil war. Explain that.
It's quite simple, and we see this with the American... Right, with American presidential elections going back to Nixon and after Johnson passed the Civil Rights Act, the central argument, and this has always been true of this country, it's true during the Revolution, we're fighting about race. And we're fighting about, and so if you look at the Republican platform, right, it's the same platform. It's, we believe that these people should be segregated. They shouldn't, they're different. They shouldn't participate. And, you know, Nixon gives us a coded language. He talks about the war on drugs, the war on crime, tax cuts, and all these things. And they're coded. And people associated with that campaign have made clear these were codes because you can't say the ugliest things outright any longer. And then the liberal left or the centrist left, and presidents like Bill Clinton adopt this language. We're going to be tough on crime. And you're right, and it's like, we're going to go slow. People aren't ready because we forget how many people in this country were opposed to the Civil Rights Act to begin with. And we forget how many people in this country are still opposed to recognizing the freedom of all Americans and to providing opportunity for all Americans. And we're expert telling ourselves the story of democracy and freedom while making exceptions for black Americans. This is true for all Americans, except these people.
Is America somewhat unique in this? I mean, the whole issue of white and black in America, and you opposed that issue historically in your book. Give us some sense of how unique the American experience is in this regard.
So American experience, it is and it is not unique. And this has always been a deeply dualistic society. And you have, on the one hand, these enlightened forces of democracy, right, that go back to some of the simple, right, that go back to Kant or so, and these great thinkers of, right, who posit that democracy is such a powerful historical force, it is destined to envelop the entire world. And when we say things like the long arc of history moves toward justice, consciously, whether knowingly or not, that's what we're paraphrasing, this idea that democracy prevails. However, we're also part of the British Empire, in which you have colonial forces and colonizing forces leaving out from Europe and, right, enslaving people, colonizing people, committing mass murders to seize land in the New World and in Australia and so forth. And both those things have defined us in our history. And those are the central things that we continue to fight about. Will we be a democracy, or are we so wed to these colonial ideas of race, right, of primacy, of one, of tribalism, of nationalism, that we can't get beyond them?
How difficult is it for America to get beyond this when, in fact, the whole idea of individualism, and we see it during the pandemic, is so emphatic in our society, and people, almost to their own detriment, will fight for that. And yet we recognize that there has been a collective discrimination, and it's been absolute, it's been in law, and there's so many ways that we have codified it that really needs to be remedied by the entire society. And we say, well, you know, if the individual just does more and really has more will and determination, it can all work out. And then we point to certain examples. So how difficult does it make for this effort to continue to go forward when that's what you're always working against?
Thank you. That's a wonderful question, Larry. Thank you for it. You see, we are individuals when we talk about white people are individual. Other people are just a group. And the white myth of individuality, which is a colonial myth, like I will go forth and be a pioneer and so forth. But that's not true when you create a New Deal, right? And when there's a Great Depression and there are problems that only government can solve. And people, as we've seen, or as we saw during the pandemic, we need government action, and there are things that government is created to ensure. And so this notion of individualism holds until there's an emergency and you realize, oh, we need a government because we are in fact a nation, people, and their problems only government is large enough to solve. However, when it comes to people of color, government's not supposed to solve their problems. And in fact, if government addresses their problem, then we invent an anti-government rhetoric, which is exactly where the rhetoric of small government comes from. It's a backlash against the efforts of government to ensure fair play for people of color. And so,
I don't think people recognize how quickly after the civil rights movement and the civil rights legislation, voting rights, that efforts to turn those back were determined, and they have been relentless ever since.
That is correct, and you have Johnson pushes it through, and he strongs arms it through the Congress, and Nixon runs, and Nixon's running in an atmosphere. It's like people weren't ready for that yet. Johnson moved too fast, too far. And we still live in a society where people aren't ready. And you listen to the rhetoric of centrist Democrats who say, it's not unique to them. There are problems to the left of them and to the right of them as well. But who say, we can only achieve so much because you see, the people are not ready. And when it comes to sharing power, forces of tyranny are never ready. And one of the things I say in this book is if we believe, right, and there's nothing new about this. Douglass says this. I mean, Lincoln says this. The first stages of the civil rights movement, the later, everyone says this. If you believe in democracy and the freedom of all people, you can't uniquely oppress people of color. You have to share power and you have to share opportunity in this nation. How difficult is that to achieve? It's as difficult now as it ever was because we still give ourselves all of this false logic and these false narratives that say it's their problem, they're different, and so on and so forth. And some people subconsciously, some people very overtly.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
The book is called A More Perfect Reunion, Race, Integration, and the Future of America. Let me go to Wade Davis. As late as yesterday, I believe he wrote this. He's an anthropologist from British Columbia. The cardinal rule of American social policy, don't let any ethnic group get below the blacks or allow anyone to suffer more indignities, rang true even in the pandemic. So here we are in this moment in time, and he's saying, never let anyone, and it's interesting, a friend of mine, his father was a Holocaust survivor and a very open-minded man who really suffered the greatest indignities anyone could, and luckily came away with his life. But he said, in America, the only thing that shields Jewish Americans, for example, typically the pariahs in various societies or those who are outcast, are the fact that there were African Americans here.
One of the things that America did at the beginning of the 20th century was to create, let me say this again, Larry, whiteness is a construction. It is... Right, it is there are biological facts of race and, you know, of phenotypical difference. However, one of the ways that American society was created was by inculcating European immigrants at the turn of the century. First it was Northern immigrants, and then the turn of the century it was millions of Jewish and Italian immigrants. You have to make them American. How do you make them American? Part of that process is through making them white. You give them, as David Nassau, one of my favorite historians of the 20th century, right? You give them spaces and you give them myths of belonging. And how do you give them these myths of belonging? Well, you tell them they're not black. You create theaters and, right, public entertainments and the, like, vaudeville minstrelsy, and you're showing, right, these myths of blacks as inferior. You create sports, and everyone can go to the park and everyone can play except, of course, black people. And then, ironically, when you integrate those spaces with the Jackie Robinson, it becomes this great cause for celebration. We've come so far. Well, you see, you had to make it segregated to begin with. Now, it's interesting that you bring up the experience of Jews in Europe, because a lot of the patterns of American, and there's nothing necessarily inventive or unique about the slurs that are aimed at African Americans. They were true of Armenians. They were true of the Jewish population in Europe. And insofar as in Germany, there was, and this is one of the precursors to the Holocaust, there comes this myth that says, or this notion that Jews are uniquely unable to be as integrated into German society. Now, part of that, right, and this is after a march beginning with the Napoleonic Law that freeze Jews essentially in Europe, and then Germans say, oh, they can never be German. And you get the same idea here, right? It's a different group, but it's the same sort of myth, of lie, of oppression, because it's a way, and it's a proven way of otherizing people. That is all. There's nothing especially clever about it. It's like, these are all ancient slurs.
When we look at integration, because that really is the focus of your book, please define for us, because you do write, 150 years later, the doors are still only partially open. We have yet to be fully received. Now, there are many white Americans who say, no, there's no apartheid in America. There's no limitation. Somebody can live next to me. Somebody can work with me. There's nothing that precludes full participation. But explain why that is not easily accepted because of the total reality that we see. I mean, we're seeing a movement today of people who are saying we haven't gotten there, and we love to applaud how far we've come. And yet, as you point out, we really need to focus on how far yet we have to go.
I think it's obvious when people are being honest. There are neighborhoods where you say we don't go. There are, when you go into any place of employment or the great majority of businesses, you may see a handful, right? You may see, we are in this place of exceptionalism. And if I work especially hard, if I'm well-credentialed and have been vouchsafed by certain institutions, then it's okay. Then I can participate. That's not true. And so if you're exceptional, you can have a perfectly good life. If you are a normal person, normal abilities, the idea that the American dream should be available to you simply does not exist. And contrary to that, we say, like, oh, you must be lazy that you haven't achieved. What's wrong with you? Right? Have we advanced further than we were from a slave state? But one of the arguments I'm making in the book is that's not the right point of measurement. What we need to measure ourselves against is how far we have to go. What would America be where there's opportunity for everyone? And we know how to, we've created Marshall Plans and New Deals and GI Bills. We know how to make opportunity. Why aren't we making that? And it's not just African Americans. African Americans are the litmus test. They've always defined, together with Native Americans, those people are uniquely unassimilatable. But there are millions of people who have been left out of American opportunity. And part of the ways that we say, part of the ways we stop creating opportunity is to say, like, oh, if you need help, if you have a problem, right, if you're not doing well, it's your fault. You're like the blacks. And so, right, you're like, oh, we're going to take apart the social safety network because who uses welfare? Well, it's black people. This was Reagan's, right? This is Reagan's stroke of brilliance that Clinton then follows. It's like, we're going to dismantle this. And again, all of this goes back to the backlash against the civil rights movement. That is when we stopped creating opportunity for all Americans, when it became clear that meant including black Americans in it as well.
You point out that there have been four crucial moments in our history that brought integration to the forefront. The Continental Congress could have dealt with it, the Civil War, as we discussed, the Civil Rights Movement in the 60s, and at present. And I've got to ask you where we are at this moment in time. Lots of people think that the demographic movement in America, where those who are brown-skinned or black-skinned will be a majority in 2050, I believe it is. We see young people arm in arm with those people of color, on the streets of America. Where are we today? And do you have some hope that perhaps in a generation or two, some of the distinctions that we have drawn so, well, purposefully in America will be undrawn?
That's a great question. And where are we? We are in a moment of racial awakening as we've been in moments of racial awakening before. And at the time of revolution, it was impossible to find a great many white Americans who, well, no, I don't see the world that way. That makes no sense. During the Civil War and after the Civil War, during the Civil Rights Movement and after the Civil Rights Movement, are there more people who believe that to be the case? Are there even, like, 90% of Americans hold attitudes that say, I believe in the principle of equality for all Americans. 30% of people support programs that achieve that in fact. And I think that we are at a moment of opportunity where we've come to understand that this is not sustainable as it is. It's not viable. There are forces that would stop the march of history, as we've seen in our president. Like, all these are counter-historical forces. The Southerners who wanted to have maintain slavery, that was counter-historical. The Confederacy, that was counter-historical. American conservatism, that's counter-historical. Those are colonial forces of oppression. There are more Americans who believe that we should live differently, but you see, you have to do the hard work of unmaking these institutions. The solution I offer in the book for that is you have to integrate these institutions. We can't just talk about it anymore. We really have to support these programs that we saw were effective after the first civil rights movement, when we saw things like busing, when we saw things like affirmative action. There was a huge backlash against those things. Why? Because Black people gained too much. And so what I'm waiting to, am I hopeful? Yes. However, I'm still waiting for it all to come together in the protests that we see now. We talk about policing, but that's only one area of harm. We have to talk about education. We have to talk about culture. We have to talk economics. We have to talk the law. It all goes together.
Calvin Baker, I live in the North. I live in Connecticut. And many might think, well, that's a pretty forward-looking place. But you certainly do not exempt liberals from what has gone on here in America as being complicit in maintaining a duality here that is unequal and is not integrated. And if I look at our communities in Connecticut, we bought into the suburban solution hard and fast. That involves zoning. That involves exclusionary practices. And it was very interesting that President Trump recently talked about the fact that I'm going to keep your suburbs just the way they are. They're not going to be crime-filled. I mean, that wasn't even code.
And one of the things, and we talk about the liberals, northern liberals are very quick to say, well, we're not the South. The coalition that is maintained or that permits Republican power, conservative power, has been, since the Civil Rights Movement, a coalition of Southerners and critically suburbanites. We don't really talk about the suburbs except as those, you know, the mythic swing voter. But you see, the suburbs exist in large part to be exclusionary. And we can tell ourselves that, right, these places were created to exclude Blacks with the federal assistance that made them possible. They were exclusionary. And one can live in a suburban town, and I happen to have spent time in Connecticut. And there's a sense that, and one will be told, there are places you go and places you don't go. And the very landscape is segregated. And right, this is a good neighborhood, that is a bad neighborhood. That's all code. These are like, this is a good school district. I don't want to live in that town because of that school district. All code. All this is raced. And it's true everywhere in this country.
Absolutely. And you talk about the fact that as long as Black people are the ones who suffer, most Americans will accept that everything is working as it should. And you point to education. 66% of Black children grow up in poverty. 6% of white kids, over 50%, go to schools that are 100% Black. So you say to yourself, well, if we're against busing and we have exclusionary zoning, but we are in favor of integrated public education, this goes back to Brown versus the Board of Education in the 50s, how do we, because you talk about the hard work involved in this process of true integration, how do we get there?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up education. One of the delightful things that I uncovered in the research for this book was colonial attitudes and sort of pre-revolutionary attitudes. And there's a lawyer who I reference in A More Perfect Reunion in the 1600s who said, well, right, because the question at revolution was, if we have emancipation, then how do we bring Black people into society? society, those people we've excluded. And there's a lawyer, he's a fairly prominent Boston lawyer of the 1600s. And so, well, that's simple. You simply send the white kids and black kids to school together, and in a couple of generations, the problem will solve itself. And so that's really, that's one of the easiest mechanisms, but we've stopped even that. And so you see, and certainly in most larger urban school districts and segregated suburban school districts, we're going backwards. And American schools are no less segregated now than they were 20, 30, 40 years ago. And so we are, and so when we say, oh, but we're moving forward, we're celebrating those people who found a way that on their own, without the aid, without the services that everyone gets, because schools are locally financed for the most part, you perpetuate inequality generation over generation. And some intervention has to happen, or it will continue to perpetuate itself. And this is, again, this is something de Tocqueville notes, and he's talking about slavery, but it's true of inequality as well. And that is, it takes great effort to establish such inequality, such, he calls it evil and tyranny, but once established, it perpetuates itself. You don't have to do anything to maintain a racially segregated, racially unequal society. All the institutions that we've created up until this point are doing it for you.
And we had liberals like FDR, the whole New Deal, the exclusionary practices in terms of mortgage acquisition as part of all of our housing laws for so long. We had Richard Rothstein on, and I believe you referenced him in the book, his incredible book about that. But I want to go back to something that you wrote that I think is just so brilliant. Blacks were punished with a century-long denial of even the most basic right for having the temerity to be living proof of the crimes their country committed against them. And I mean, that is so powerful, and it hits you right between the eyes as a white American. And I know there are many books today meant to help white Americans figure out how their bias creeps into everything that they do, even when it's unknowing, unwitting, and unmeant that, you know, we mean to do the right things. There are so many wrong things in the whole system that we're not trying to root out with enough intent. So where do we begin? What do we do now?
You have to begin everywhere. And one of the, because these are interlocking systems, right, because economic inequality and educational and cultural inequalities, all of these combine to serve the same purposes. And you have to intervene at every site. And it's one thing to say, oh, I'm going to examine my own biases, I want, but we've been through these moments of awakening before. And it's important to understand that the New Deal, FDR could only get the New Deal through if he allowed the South cutouts by which to exclude African Americans from any government programs. That the same thing is true of the GI Bill. The same thing is true of federal housing, federal mortgage insurance, and all these things that create wealth and a social safety network for white Americans excluded Black Americans. And it's necessary to know those things. However, once you've come to a place in your own consciousness that says, I mean, Larry, I like you. I don't want to go down all the rabbit holes in your mind. Once you come to say, you know, I think that this should be a more egalitarian society. It should be a fairer society. There may be winners and losers, but we've got to do better than we're doing now. Then you have to look at everything. You have to look at every space around you. You have to look at the school districts in your town, in your neighborhood. You have to look at your place of employment. You have to look at the government and the houses of government. And you have to demand, you have to make demands at each of those sites. And you have, and beyond making the demands, you have to hold yourself and others accountable. By which, it's not enough to say we wish to do better. You have to say, well, what does doing better look like?
if we were doing better, right, by what extent do we want to reduce poverty in America? By what extent do we want to share opportunity? And then you hold yourself to that. And that's a different challenge than saying, oh, well, I want to know more and I want to examine my own bias. We all have biases and some we privilege and hold you to, but you've got to have goals. And that is, that's largely the point of this book. If we want to move forward, we have to have goals for doing so. And we have to have a framework, a conceptual framework, that of what the future looks like. And I argue that what the future looks like in a just society is one in which American opportunity is not segregated. Full stop.
But when I go back to the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments after the Civil War, and then the measures that were taken to make certain they were unenforceable, when I look at the Civil Rights Movement, the voting rights, fair housing, all of these things, and then I realize that the march of the conservative movement in America since has been to push back on all of those things. If I were a Black American, I would say, I don't believe that there's going to be a sustainable, ongoing, consistent, systemic effort to really remedy this. There's nothing in our history that suggests that we are serious about really taking that hard and long road toward real integration.
The solutions, we sit around and we act as though the solutions are mysterious. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 is modeled after those amendments, and it's only restoring the rights of America that African Americans lost.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You had a 100-year period where those promises were never kept.
And we're on the verge of a real referendum right now. And one of the genius of the civil rights movement is it doesn't say we're going to look at this site. It says we're going to look at housing. There's going to be an intervention at the site of housing, of employment, of education, of voting, because these are sites where racism is not only endemic but also recreated every day. Every time you send your child to a segregated school, you're reinforcing race and racism. Every time you participate in a racially segregated economy, you're reinforcing these things. This is the sliver of promise. Those people born in the 60s and onwards are the first Americans who have not been wholly shaped by segregation. And for people who are wholly shaped by segregation, a little desegregation is that's a big win. That's a massive step. But you see, that step has been made before. We have to make the next steps, not from reactive, oh, we want to desegregate, to the active. We want to open up opportunity. We know how to do that. I think that I think the majority of Americans wish to do so. I think that there are deeply entrenched forces that understand as well as we do that the levers you have to utilize to maintain white control are voter suppression, are school segregation, are economic oppression. And that's what they work to do. We have to work against that if we want to achieve a more equal future.
When I look back at the presidency of Barack Obama and lots of people thinking that was really a watershed moment in American history, and it was. And then I see the forceful reaction to that in the form of Donald Trump. And then I look on television during the pandemic, and I am meeting so many incredibly astute and aware African-American, Latino leaders across America, their mayors, their county officials, and I'm impressed by that. I mean, should I? Is that a signal that maybe things are beginning to change? And many of those people are in southern states and western states, perhaps not as much of here in the north.
Now, that is, again, you have to ask yourself, how slowly or quickly do we want to do this? And do we want to leave it to some process that we tell ourselves will happen naturally? That will take, I mean, I've calculated, it will take hundreds of years at the present rate of change. And it's funny, Larry, I was talking to an older black gentleman. He's in his late 70s, early 80s, a brilliant man. He's had a phenomenal career. And he's a scientist, and we were talking, so, you know, Calvin, I think you're amazing. I think you're too militant. You're more militant than I am. And I'm not militant. I'm not advocating any form of violence. And he says, they're not ready. They're not ready. And he gives me, I felt like I was talking to my grandfather. I felt like I was, you could have been talking to W.D. Du Bois. And when you talk to most centrists, this is the attitude that obtains. Yeah, we need to do something, just not too much. And what I'm saying is, as someone who was born after the civil rights movement, who, and I think this is what a lot of younger people are saying, we want to go faster, we must go faster. I'm impatient with the slow walking. We're going to have a token here. We're going to have a token there. And the Obamas represented, it was a watershed moment. There's no denying that as representation. There's also no denying the fact that there are policies that have been built up with liberal and Republican and conservative support that are detrimental to African Americans that even a black president can't counter. Only the American people can counter. So we talk, like, elected officials are wonderful, but they largely do the bidding of who they perceive their constituency to be. And this is a question not only for American politicians, for the American people themselves. And when we look at the protests, the Black Lives Matter protests, when we look at the Civil Rights Movement, these are mass mobilizations of the American public. This isn't a politician leading us to the future. This is Americans demanding that it be made so.
You say, and I'll leave with this because there is so much that people need to delve into your book, A More Perfect Reunion, Calvin Baker. But let's leave on this note, because I love quoting you, because there's nothing more eloquent than some of your own words. Integration, which is nothing less than full equality, is a state that can exist where the line of race is not eternally recreated. America does that in every century, in every moment in time, at every watershed moment, we push back and we recreate that line. How do we know in the future, maybe it's going to be 2-3 generations down the line, that we really have erased that line, not just redrawn it in a better place for some people, but really erased it?
One of my litmus tests is, right, well, because I say we're still living in segregated frames. When you walk down the street, when you walk into a space, it will not look segregated to you. When you walk into a school, it won't be segregated. When you walk into a neighborhood, it will not be segregated. And when you walk into a court, it won't be segregated. And these are obvious things. And I would argue that we have to do a special sort of self-sedation to tell ourselves that what we're seeing is, in fact, integrated. That's only compared to apartheid, not compared to a just society of equals. Right? That's the goal, a universal democracy.
Calvin Baker, I can't thank you enough for being with us today to have this conversation on America Trends. It has been just my honor to host you today. The book, again, A More Perfect Reunion, Calvin Baker, here on America Trends. Thanks again, Calvin.
Thank you, Larry. It's a great pleasure.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.